Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Robert Kagan is a potent conservative thinker who spoke up loud and early for American force to remove Saddam Hussein and championed war with Iraq. He's a neocon luminary, a sharp analyst of Europe and America, and an emerging historian to boot. His new history of America's early centuries argues that even from its colonial era, this has been, as his book's title has it, a dangerous nation. Imagining itself a benign city on the hill, a peace-loving model of liberty, but in fact a messianic, expansionist, power-projecting empire on the make. It's history that makes the Iraq War look almost inevitable, and Robert Kagan is fine with that. Up next on Point, American DNA and Robert Kagan's Dangerous Nation. Robert Kagan, are you there?
Hi, how are you? Yes, I am.
Let me give my little introduction. We've got Robert Kagan. He, with Weekly Standard editor William Crystal, is co-founder of the Project for the New American Century, a group that strongly supported U.S. intervention in Iraq. He's often described as a neoconservative luminary, though he does not embrace that term. He's a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His 2003 bestseller was Of Paradise and Power. Your new book is Dangerous Nation, America's Place in the World from Its Earliest Days to the Dawn of the 20th Century. We're delighted to have you with us there from Brussels. Thanks a lot for being here.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
We want to get into both the history that you described quite wonderfully here and its implications and understand the interpretation that you're giving to American history. I guess every historian does that. But begin to take us in first, if you would, Robert Kagan, to your big thesis here. I've taken a swing at it, but how do you describe what it is that you want to get across with the history we're about to dive into?
Well, first of all, I do want to emphasize that it is a history. It's not a current policy recommendation. I've got a second volume coming out, which will end much sooner to where we are right now. Mm-hmm. But my goal is really to explain what America has been in its history in terms of a power in the world. And I guess I would say I'm challenging a notion which I think is fairly pervasive. And that notion is that basically the United States in its early decades and even throughout its first century was focused mostly on its internal affairs, that it was interested in perfecting its democracy and dealing with various internal issues, and was basically not interested in affecting the rest of the world and involving itself in the rest of the world. People look back at Washington's farewell address, which I think is widely misunderstood, to suggest that the United States should never get entangled with other powers. And my argument is that from the very beginning, in fact, even from before the Revolution, the United States, before it was the United States, Americans were a very expansive people, both territorially, commercially, but also, and particularly after the Revolution, ideologically, and always conceived that what was going on in the rest of the world, particularly in the struggle between liberty and despotism, as James Madison described it, was of enormous importance to Americans, and that helped very much shape their foreign policy.
We really do want to go to that history, but let me just ask you, so our listeners can have on board, as we hear it, why you think this is an important message today, an important insight today.
Well, first of all, let me just say I started writing this book in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was in office. Mm-hmm. So this precedes the present set of arguments. But my view at the time and now is that Americans run into trouble by not understanding themselves and their own behavior well enough and their own character and their own history. We often talk about how Americans don't understand the rest of the world. I think a primary problem is that Americans misread themselves. And this has two consequences. One is that Americans are repeatedly unaware of their own expansive nature and how they affect other peoples and other cultures around the world. That we are, in fact, a very intrusive people and have been from the beginning. That we regard people who have different political systems than our own as fundamentally illegitimate and would like to see them changed. And that these views, as well as our cultural expansiveness, have impinge on other peoples who then frequently react to our impingement in their sphere. And this has happened to us again and again throughout our history. And so we're surprised at the world's reaction to us, and frequently we're unprepared for that reaction because we're so unaware of the effect that we're having on the rest of the world.
You wrote last month in the Washington Post, you said, "Today, many hope and believe that the difficulties in Iraq will turn Americans once and for all against ambition and messianism in the world. History is not on their side." So give us some of that history as you tell it. Take us all the way back to the sort of history here with pilgrims and Puritans and right on up. What are some of the key kind of moments that fix in our minds what you see as a mythology of city on a hill, non-entanglement? How do you interpret them in a different direction?
For instance, the Puritans, we always talk about them being desiring to separate themselves from Europe and to build this city upon a hill that would be aloof from the rest of the world, aloof from the impurities and imperfections. When in fact, as the greatest historians of Puritanism have written, people like Perry Miller decades ago, the Puritans were revolutionary. They wanted to transform Europe, primarily in the first case England, but then eventually Protestant Europe in their own image, and that their landing in North America was, as Perry Miller described it, a flank attack. They hoped eventually to return to a reformed England along the model that they wanted to create, and that ultimately failed even in the North American continent.
So the kind of spiritual empire they had in mind, then you would
say. They believed there was a certain kind of Protestantism, a certain kind of Christianity, which was the only acceptable kind. They tried to create that commonwealth here in North America, but more importantly, their goal was to return ultimately to an England in that image. So right away, to view the Puritans as isolationist, as is often the case, is a mistake. But even then, the Puritans were hardly the dominant force in even colonial America. The dominant force was a kind of Anglo-American imperialism. Some of the leading imperialists of our history were people like Benjamin Franklin, who immediately wanted to go to war with France over contested territories in the Ohio Valley, wanted to plant colonies deep into the Ohio Valley, and in fact lobbied in London for what became the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War. George Washington was one of the leading imperialists of the day in terms of wanting control of all that vast Western territory.
When he talked about non-entanglement then, how do you interpret that? Put that in the context that you share.
The context was that what Washington was saying in the farewell address, in addition, by the way, to fighting a very political battle against Thomas Jefferson, which was the real purpose of that document, but what he was really saying and what Alexander Hamilton, who helped him write that document, was saying was, we need 10 or 15 or maybe 20 years of steering clear of these European fights, because at that point we would become strong enough to be a power standing on our own, and as Washington says in the farewell address, able to bid defiance to any power on earth and to go to war as our sense of justice determines. And so it was really a temporary strategy because people like Washington, Hamilton, Jefferson, Franklin, that entire founding generation, and this is a thing that I even was surprised by when I went back and did the research, is always believed that the United States would become the greatest power on earth. And that was their ambition. They expected it would take several decades, but that was their expectation as well as their ambition.
Robert Kagan is with us. His new book is Dangerous Nation. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, is with us as well. Jack, we're going to dive on into this 19th century history that Robert takes forward. But what about this basic idea that he's putting forward here, that Americans have a kind of lack of self-awareness about just what an aggressive, expansionist nation they've been, a dangerous nation they've been?
Well, I think there's no question about that. Bill Clinton used to quote, made up actually a quote from Tocqueville, where he said, Americans are a great people because they're a good people. Well, Tocqueville didn't say that, as many pointed out. But I think that view has prevailed, that we are both great and good. And historically, those things have been hard to combine in the same nation. And many nations that see us as great don't see us as good. And Americans have tended to think the two things go together. Well, it's hard to say that if you were an Indian in the 19th century, hard to say it if you were a Mexican. and on forward. So I do think there's been a good deal of innocence about our character. And I think this book richly brings out the other side, that we have in fact been an aggressive, expanding power right from the beginning. What I miss, however, is the other tradition, the tradition of dissent, of Republican dissent, really summed up very well by Theodore Parker talking about the Mexican War. He said it'd be a gain to mankind if we could spread over Mexico the idea of America, that all men are born free and equal. But he said, first, we must make real those ideas at home. And the Republican tradition of dissent has consistently said, let's perfect our domestic arrangements before we visit them on the world.
Robert Kagan, Jack has laid some more pieces on the table, and we definitely want to look at this 19th century history. But let me just ask you first about this, where you're coming from here. Are you, in addition to illuminating, as an historian would do, are you celebrating this side of the American equation? Are you saying this is what we are, let's be it without apologies, and so off we go if necessary in Iraq or wherever?
Well, I hope I can say this credibly. I'm actually just trying to explain. I'm not certainly not celebrating it. You can't read my account of Americans' treatment of the Native American Indians. You cannot read my account of the South's effort to expand slavery, which, by the way, was what the Mexican War was about, and which is why people like Lincoln and others were so opposed to it. It wasn't so much the taking of the territory, it was the fact that it was taking territory for slavery. It's not a pretty picture in many cases, and it certainly doesn't fit the myth of America the good and America the innocent. That is, as Jack says, impossible to square with what we've done. I think, you know, but it's also not a condemnation either. I really am just interested in trying to explain our behavior so we understand ourselves better and don't live by these myths and continue to fool ourselves.
I promise we'll turn right back to the history then. But again, just so we understand the context, where would you put Iraq in that spectrum of noble or ugly endeavors here? You pushed hard for intervention against Saddam Hussein in the late 90s and early in this decade. Where do you put that conflict now? Would you group it with the uglier episodes you just described or something else?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways to decide whether something is ugly or unfortunate or any other judgment that you want to make. You know, a lot of the actions in the early part of American history, a lot of the wars that we fought, the near extermination of the Indians, was done almost entirely for selfish, tangible selfish reasons, for money, for land. And that, I think, is what I would cast strong moral judgment against. Whatever else you want to say about Iraq, it was not undertaken for those kinds of interests. It may have been followed a different kind of model of American action, which is the idealistic effort that fails on practical grounds. Which, by the way, can mean that it was a mistake from the beginning. I think that Vietnam was largely undertaken for mostly idealistic reasons, and it was a failure. So it is possible, and in fact, this is the paradox that Americans are frequently confronting, that often the desire to do good by our standards, and I think it's important to emphasize those are our judgments, not necessarily the world's judgments, the desire to do good often leads to bad outcomes. But let me just say, the same idealistic desire can also lead to very important and good outcomes. And it's, you know, people want to say if a war ends badly, that means that the motives were bad. If a war ends well, that means the motives were good. But I would say that generally American motives are fairly consistent, but sometimes the outcome is an unfortunate outcome.
We'll put the questions of oil and deception going in aside for a moment. Roll back the tape then with us as the historian. Jack quotes Adams saying, yeah, you know, great is the guilt of unnecessary war. Take us back to that. How does that square with your telling here, Robert Kagan?
Well, first of all, I totally agree with Jack that there's a dissenting tradition. I don't really think I slide it. I mean, the dissenting tradition begins at the very birth of the nation when the so-called anti-federalists who were opposing the Constitution, one of the famous anti-federalists is Patrick Henry, who accused the proponents of the Constitution, which of course were Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, of wanting an empire. And he said, we were not meant to be an empire, and you want to impose this great empire upon us. There was a time, sir, when liberty was what we were seeking, and now we're doing something else. And that that tradition persists throughout American history. You can see that same argument made against the War of 1812, where people like John Randolph were arguing this was a war for vanity, and like the ancient Romans or the ancient Greeks, it was not about preserving what we are. You could see it, of course, in the Spanish-American War. There were few opponents to that, but that was the argument that they made, and right through the 20th century. Even Robert Taft, who is now reviled as an isolationist on World War II and afterwards, was making that same case. That we would wield our power, we would, as John Quincy Adams said, become the dictatress of the world, but we would lose our own soul. And this has been a consistent theme. My argument is not that this doesn't exist and hasn't played a role. It's that even though these judgments have been made and these criticisms have been made, it is interesting to see how over time that has not been the winning argument. That even though these cases have been laid out in this way, by and large, the country has gone in the direction of larger, expansive foreign policy, not in the direction of looking more inward and worrying about our soul.
Jack, it is the Spanish-American War that's often seen, as you know, as the kind of turning point. We were good and reserved until then, and then we had our steel-hulled Navy, and off we went, boom, boom.
Yeah, and I think one of the things he really brings out is that really isn't so. I mean, my gosh, the Mexican War alone, which was really an aggressive war on our part, and alone could disprove that. But then he also shows right through from the Civil War on, we were intervening and involving ourselves in Pacific affairs and Samoa and Hawaii and other places, and that far from being an aberration, 1898 was really part of that continuum. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is to put 1898 against what was going on in the rest of the world. The rest of the world, the European powers were lurching for empire. Mm. And in Cuba, even if many of our motives were in fact humanitarian, at least at the beginning, we were too. So what looks like a noble motive to Americans, if you step back a little bit and notice the European powers were doing similar things, looks like imperialism that way. And of course, the Cuban, we did liberate the Cubans from the Spanish who were doing terrible things to them. Mm. But then we saddled on their constitution the Platt Amendment, named after a senator, that basically gave us the right to intervene in Cuba when we wanted. And they had to accept that amendment to their constitution, or we wouldn't take our troops away. And of course,
that's quite a trapdoor in a constitution and sovereignty.
Right. And of course, it also gave us the right to Guantanamo indefinitely. So the Platt Amendment, what the humanitarian motives of the war gave with the one hand, you could say the Platt Amendment took away with the other.
Let us get a caller here, and we'll get back to Robert Kagan. But first, in Northborough, Massachusetts, Bill is calling. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree with your guest that we are appallingly ignorant of our past, and I would suggest that we pay a very high price for that ignorance. What I strongly disagree with your guest about is that just because that's the way our past has always been doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way the future is going to have to be. It seems to me that a great power, especially when we became the only great power, had an opportunity to say, look, let's as a bunch of nations get together and see if we can't change the paradigm here and come up with some sort of standard of universal justice where we could all live with that mm-hmm. universal justice. Mm-hmm. This idea of we're top dog, we have to do whatever we have to be in order to stay top dog, it simply isn't going to work anymore. There are up-and-coming top dogs.
And it's outliving its utility, maybe, among other things. Robert Kagan, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
And you hear that. How about it? This goes, in many ways, right to the rub. I mean, your project for the New American Century is seen by many as promoting exactly what our caller Bill says he doesn't want to see, which is let's take our hard-nosed toughness, power, strongly right forward into a new century. Bill says, can't we, you know, follow a learning curve beyond all this? And I read you saying no.
Well, first of all, you keep bringing up the Project for the New American Century. Let me just say that was founded in the 1990s to support. It wound up mostly supporting Bill Clinton's efforts to deal with problems in the Balkans. We were mostly against the Republicans at that time, who were constantly saying we had no business in dealing with the Balkans. And so, you know, there's more to the project than you're talking about. But setting that aside, the caller makes a critical point, which is, and I totally agree. In theory, just because we have behaved a certain way for 250 years doesn't mean that that necessarily is the way we need to behave in the future. The only thing I would say, however, is that the things that make us, that have made us behave in this way, are very powerful elements of our identity as a nation. I would say the two critical factors in American behavior are, one, the principles enunciated in the Declaration of Independence, the whole idea of inalienable rights, the equality of all men, etc., which we, by the way, ourselves violated for the first 80 years of our history. But those ideas are considered to be the truth by Americans. And really, even whether you're a liberal, a conservative, you put any label you want, I run across very few Americans who say that is a debatable question.
Yep.
And so when we look out at the rest of the world, we see countries through the lens of that essentially liberal enlightenment worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes we go to war. More often, we express our unhappiness.
But you're saying there's something intrinsically messianic in that.
That's right. Because unlike other nations who have a real nationalism that's rooted in blood, it's rooted in soil, a Frenchman is a Frenchman regardless
because
he's
born
in France.
There. Right, right.
Right. Americans are only Americans because they accept these basic principles. Therefore, you know, right at the heart of our nationalism is this internationalist view, which is a meddling view by its very nature.
So there's half of it.
That's half of it. The other half is power. When we have less power, as we did in the early years of our history, we were much less inclined to take our values and principles and either forcibly or attempt to influence others. The more power we acquired over the next 200 years, the more we did attempt to shape the world in our image. And so if you wanted to ask me what was the best antidote to this American behavior, it would be a severe diminution of our power, because it's very difficult for Americans, if they have the ability to do something, to walk away from it. And that is the history. That is the history that we have been so far.
But take us to Bill's question here about this possibility of evolution, of a learning curve. I mean, you come from sort of a kind of first family of American conservatives. Brother Frederick Kagan has talked recently with us about a surge of troops in Iraq. Your father, Donald Kagan, professor at Yale, was my professor at Yale of the classics and ancient Greece. Here you are right in the thick of this, advising John McCain, I read. And, of course, he's a big supporter of a surge in Iraq. Does that mean, are you the kind of conservative who doesn't believe in the evolution of national behavior or the interaction of nations, you know, that we just have to sort of saddle up, put on the armor, and get out there?
I mean, you know, I hate to have everything be about the surge, you know, when I'm writing about things that happened 200 years ago. But here's what I think. I would say, forget about what I think. It is in the American character to be highly suspicious of letting other nations have an equal say with America in terms of the direction of the world. And that goes throughout our history. People talk about unilateralism. We have been among the most unilateralist nations in history from our very beginning. I mean, if there was one thing that was true about what people interpret Washington's farewell address, it is that we don't want to be bound by the decisions of other nations. We only trust ourselves. And this is also related to the Declaration of Independence. We are the only keepers of the received truth according to ourselves. So we can never really trust anybody else to be doing the right thing. And if you go even to the famous post-World War II period and you read, there's a wonderful biography of Dean Acheson out now by Robert Beisner. You read what Dean Acheson thought about the United Nations. He thought it was a load of bunk, and that the only thing that could protect our values and the peace in the world was American power. And that is Bill Clinton, 50 years later, talks about the indispensable nation. Now, what does that mean? You know, if you go to Europe, as I live in Europe these days, you talk about America being the indispensable nation. They don't think that's a wonderful phrase. They think that's an arrogant statement. But it is an indication of how, despite all the talk we talk sometimes about international institutions, we of all the countries in the world have been the least willing to cede our ability to act to those kinds of institutions.
And those echoes very loud, most recently in this Bush administration. Jack.
Yeah, Tom, I mean, the break, I think that's very well said, messianism and power. The break on that in the American tradition has been realism. That's the tradition you see in George Kennan and Hans Morgenthau and the people that I learned from, who basically said ends and means have to be related. Mm. If you aim to redeem the world, you ain't got the power to do it. If you aim to transform a society that has been on one track for 3,000 years, you ain't got the power to do that. And the wisdom of statesmen is to understand that their means and their ends have to coincide. And if you're taking on something too big, no amount of power is going to do it. And that the United States forever has to be inoculating itself against that messianic impulse because it doesn't have the power on the one hand and it doesn't have the right on the other.
Kevin's calling from Boston. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I hear you guys talking about the Spanish-American War, mm-hmm. which has been a kind of a personal rant of mine, and I'm wondering why I don't hear more people making comparisons between the Iraq War and the Spanish-American War.
What's the parallel that you would draw?
Well, just on the face of it, I mean, just things that I remember from high school history, like the terminology, the Butcher of Baghdad, the Butcher of Havana, the Remember the Maine, and... George Bush would like to say remember September 11th, but I don't think he'd get away with that. So he said remember the lessons of September 11th. But.
Got it. And we've got the historian right here with us. Let's put it to him. Robert Kagan, how about it? Do you see legitimate comparison parallels here?
Well, I do. And if you read the end of my book, which is about the Spanish-American mm-hmm. War and all the mixed motives that brought us into it, I think there are parallels. One parallel is that as in the case of the Iraq War, the Spanish-American War had overwhelming national support from left to right. The only groups that were opposed to the war were business groups who were worried about their investments in Cuba. There was no question that there was horrible things happening in Cuba. What the Spanish government, especially Weyler, was doing led to a virtual extermination of about a fifth of the Cuban population through starvation and disease.
Was there also deceit involved, as it appears there was in the ramp up to the Iraq War?
Well, we could debate how much deceit was involved. The thing about the Maine was kind of funny because most Americans assumed that the Maine was blown up by the Spaniards. McKinley basically did not believe that that was the case. He thought it was probably some renegade group that had done it. But the Maine became a kind of catalyst, although by no means was it the reason ultimately that the United States went to war in Cuba, but it was a catalyst. And I think purely as a historical matter, not in terms of a moral judgment, in the same way that September 11th was also a catalyst, whether these things are related, you know, whether they're really the reason you go to war or not, sometimes these events do have an impact. And the final thing that I think is important parallel is that the war to liberate Cuba was undertaken largely for humanitarian reasons. Yes, America had interests in the region. Yes, America wanted to transplant Spain, but it was largely humanitarian. But as a result of our effort to do good in Cuba, we wound up, in fact, being saddled with an occupation that did not lead to particularly good results in Cuba. And we also wound up with a much bigger disaster on our hands in the Philippines, where we wound up with a very angry Filipino population.
Huge insurgency.
Mm-hmm. And a huge insurgency, which went on and on and mm-hmm. on for four awful years. Mm. And so there are these kinds of parallels.
Does that
and
parallel, the parallel then, I'm sorry, but does it leave you then abashed in your support for the Iraq War, or just a historian looking on?
Well, I mean, you know, one has multiple roles in life. I mean, I try to take an analytical view as a historian and look back and see what we are. As a person living in our times, I take views on what is the right thing to do at that moment, and so I try to separate those two. Now, in terms of what Iraq is, obviously, Iraq. I think the reasons for going into Iraq were right. I think Saddam Hussein. I cannot wish that Saddam Hussein was still in power today in Iraq. I do not believe the world would be a better place if Saddam Hussein was still in power in Iraq. But obviously, the way the war was carried out has been disastrous so far, and I hope that we can figure out a way to pull ourselves out of it. But what I am conscious of, even as I, you know, sometimes succumb to idealistic desires to improve these kinds of situations, is I am conscious of the ironies that often, that, you know, Reinhold Niebuhr talked about the ironies of American history, that in trying to do good, you can wind up doing bad. And this is a reality, but what to do about that reality is a harder question.
The way we understand our history can have a lot to do with the way we act today. Robert Kagan's with us. His book is Dangerous Nation. I want to welcome into our conversation for a moment here from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Graham Allison. He's professor of government at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs there, author of Realizing Human Rights and Nuclear Terrorism. Graham Allison, I know you've been listening along here. Thanks very much for being with us. What do you make of Robert Kagan's history and his interpretation as it relates to America right now?
Well, I applaud Bob's getting back into the history and helping us see the origins and lots of the impulses. Mm-hmm. But I think I think he's actually, in coming to appreciate the irony, as he put it, as in Niebuhr's terms, of the fact that idealism can often have its wheels fall off if it's not married to a realistic assessment of how to get from here to there, is an advance. And I think that the proposition that he argues in the book, that the U.S. is a powerful, idealistic country, is certainly right. But that does not mean that we have to exercise that power foolishly or execute our undertakings incompetently. So I think that to whatever extent this story relates to Iraq, it seems to me to be basically a demonstration that over a long period of time, the U.S. has been powerful and idealistic. Mostly, it has not exercised that power foolishly. Mm. It has not executed incompetently, but from time to time it has. And Iraq seems to me to be a rather striking demonstration that the enthusiasm, especially of the neocons, for this undertaking, which I think was a foolish undertaking, and an execution of it, which I think has been incompetent, has been a huge mistake.
Do you see this as history wrapped in ideology then, or just getting to the nub of what the country's really about?
Well, I think Bob's attempt to distinguish between himself as a historian and himself as a policy advocate is I accept that. And I think that in understanding the history, appreciating that we actually have a deep set of ideals, that these are expressed very clearly in the Declaration of Independence, that does make us a non-status quo country, a revolutionary country. All that is exactly right. And I think we've been ultimately mostly a power for good in international relations. But that doesn't, I think, excuse in any way the notion that, well, we'll just exercise power promiscuously or foolishly. Power can be exercised for good or for ill. I think Bob said earlier in the conversation, you know, idealism can lead to good results, or indeed, unless married to some realistic assessment of how to get from here to there, can lead to disaster. In fact, I think the great irony of the neocons in Iraq is that if they had read the first generation of neocons, Bill Kristol's father, Irving, and the people who did the public interest, their core idea, their absolutely core idea, was that ambitious social engineering at home or abroad will most frequently have unanticipated consequences that undermine the ends in question. So I think that's what got missed in this case, and I think to the great pain of the country and the world.
Robert Kagan, how about it? Do we fall on this path that you describe into the danger of a promiscuous application of American power?
Well, I mean, it may turn out to be the case, but what I really object to in Dr. Allison's account is his account of America's past as if we have never gotten ourselves into these kinds of problems and all our policies have been conducted relatively competently. I mean, it's impossible to look at American history and say that that's the case, including, and I want to go back to
so
something.
Does that mean you see Iraq as kind of par for the course? It sure looks costly and full of blunders. Is that
well,
par?
Well, gee, you know, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I think that Vietnam and the Korean War were also disasters in their own different ways.
So does that mean Iraq is okay because it's like, well, I mean...
No, would you're I'm sorry to say, you're unbelievably fixated on Iraq, and if you want to have a show on Iraq, let's have a show on Iraq. But I'm trying to understand. First of all, I started writing this book in 1996. Mm-hmm. 1996. I wrote 90% of it before the Iraq War started. This book is not about the Iraq War. I'm happy to discuss the Iraq War, but let's just go back. And again, I want to pick up on something that Jack Beatty said about the realists.
And we can't really apologize for that Iraq concern. After all, we're sitting on it as we talk. You're advising on it, so it's all of one piece. I think that could be a useful thing. But please go back to Jack.
Well, no, I'm not trying to avoid the discussion about Iraq, but if we wrap this up and try to look at all of American history through the lens of Iraq, we may wind up with some distortions. And we take a very short view in this case, and I'm afraid that's what Dr. Allison has done. Look, go back to the immediate post-World War II period. Mm. By the way, there were realists at the time arguing that we ought to now pull back, especially in Europe. And the doctrine of containment, which Dean Acheson and Harry Truman set forth, which is now revered, was violently opposed by the realists at the time, especially by people like Walter Lippmann and George Kennan, who saw in it an endless war because the United States would have to fight anywhere and everywhere that the Soviet Union chose or any communist movement developed. And this, they thought, was an exact the problem of gaps between ends and means. This was exactly what was going to happen. Now, you know what? Their critique was right to some extent because the doctrine of containment is what got us into the Vietnam War.
Let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Wayne. Hi, Wayne. You're on the line.
Thanks for taking my call. I think Dr. Keegan's absolutely right. If we even go back to pre-revolution, we see George Washington completely violating the king's order not to buy land on the other side of the Appalachians.
He went for it.
He went out there and took it.
Mm-hmm.
And then with no title whatsoever, just took it. He, Ethan Allen, a whole bunch of them.
So George Washington wasn't afraid to reach out and grab that land. And what does that tell us today, Wayne?
That's right. That's exactly right. And when we... that one of the first things we did that first 5 minutes was legitimize his title to that land.
And what's the significance of that for us today, as you see?
That the aggression that Dr. Keegan is talking about is driven by profit motive.
Let us go to John in Milford, Connecticut. And Wayne, thanks for your call. John, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. My point is that the nations of the world are not, many of them are not unlike this nation. And if you look at the British Empire, its rise and fall, I hope we won't be falling in the same way, but its rise, it's very much the same. I think when countries have the power, they seek more of it. They seek to realize their national and international goals by the use of that power.
So we weren't the first, we won't be the last, you say. Human nature, and yet we've got also a powerful kind of messianic document in a way in the Declaration of Independence that might be a little different. Let's get one more call from Nathan in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Nathan, you're on the air.
Yeah, let me qualify my opinion briefly. I'm an Air Force brat that grew up in post-war Japan from 74 till 78.
Mm-hmm.
Almost 5 years, so almost...
Okay,
and
you got it.
Anyway, and I grew up in California.
Okay.
So here's the deal. War is always the answer, unfortunately. We were treated like family and kings and just treated like kings by the Japanese.
Defeated Japan.
In Japan. We lived on Tachikawa Air Force Base in Yokota. And
but why do you say war is always the answer, Nathan?
Well, history has proven it. I look at myself like a rock sitting on, and I mean a stone, sitting on the side of the mountain watching all the ants run around. The paradigms of power are always shifting. And the simplest way I can put it is this. This country in 200 years has broken and rebuilt every country that we ever broke. And we're doing that right now in Iraq. And what has been dropped is the seed of freedom. For the first time in 3,000 years, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, women are a part of the government.
Yeah, and our time is short, Nathan. We've got the heart of that, and I thank you for that call. So there on the one hand, Nathan says war's the answer. On the other here, I see Dwight Eisenhower saying, I think that people want peace so much that one of these days government had better get out of their way and let them have it. Robert Kagan, is war the answer? Does peace become a more possible, durable status at some point with this American character you describe?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's obvious that the world has yet reached the moment when there'll be no need for military forces, when there'll be no need for war. If anything, as I look ahead into the coming years, I think that, you know, military capabilities are going to be more necessary, perhaps, than they were even during the Cold War. I mean, it's interesting to see that since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the United States has been involved in more military interventions than it was during the Cold War, not less. And I think there's something about the sort of general reshaping of the world and the chaotic sense, the chaotic reality of the world that leaves this. We're far from the nirvana of international peace. Mm. But what I wanted to just say was, you know, the same things that make us capable to do good things in the world, this is the paradox, the same things that make us capable of doing good in the world also lead us to make the kinds of mistakes that Graham Allison is talking about. And it's not just a question of shifting our doctrine in one direction or the other. I do agree with Graham Allison that at the end of the day, competence of execution is the critical difference between successful ventures and unsuccessful ventures. But the notion that the United States is going to stay out of these kinds of issues in the future, I think, runs directly contrary to our history as a nation and our character as a nation.
Graham Allison, I guess the last word may go to you today. 30 seconds here. Your thought.
Well, I think Bob's last point is certainly one that I agree with. I think the appreciating the fact, as his book asserts, in the title, The Dangerous Nation, that we're not a status quo power, that we do believe that all men are created equal, that we do believe in freedom for the world, is certainly a crucial point. But the question is how to advance that freedom agenda, and it does not, I think, require exercising power foolishly or executing it incompetently.
Yeah, too many Vietnams, too many Iraqs, we may not have the power to exercise. I want to thank everyone for being here today. Graham Allison at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Jack Beatty, great as always to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Robert Kagan, author of Dangerous Nation, joining us from Brussels. Mr. Kagan, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.